Hello, John, are you out
I
there?
am here. Hi, George.
Ah, good, it's been a while.
Yeah, really.
How have you been?
I'm pretty good. I'm sure our hordes of fans have been wondering what the hell happened to John and George.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I was out in Princeton a couple weeks ago and I saw our leader, Robert Wright.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I just had time to, I dropped by Blogging Heads central headquarters, and which turns out to be a coffee shop near the campus called something like Small World Coffee, I think. It's apparently the enlightened alternative to Starbucks.
You mean when you say that's the headquarters, they don't
Oh, I
actually
was just
film,
kidding.
Bob doesn't actually tape himself
No,
there.
no. Yeah, I was just kidding. I
Yeah.
don't. I. Yeah. Yeah, he was just out and about, and had just finished swimming apparently somewhere, and then we met for coffee. It was just a quick trip. I was giving a talk at the Princeton Plasma Physics Lab on the 10 Most Beautiful Experiments, and I took advantage of that trip to do some interviews for my cancer book, and then just to catch up briefly with Bob.
The plasma physics lab, Jesus, that still exists?
Yeah, it does. It was,
That's
yeah.
such a blast from the past. Well, as you
I
know, I
know.
was hoping that we could talk some physics today because there are a couple of Science Saturday watchers who have been complaining about all the social science, squishy, soft stuff that
Oh,
people have been talking
yeah.
about.
So we want
So
some real
physics.
science here. Yeah,
Yeah,
no, that's good.
like
Well,
multiverse
yeah.
theory and string theory and all that really hardcore, rigorous science.
And plasma fusion,
Plasma fusion. George,
the great hope.
they don't still have the so I went down there when I was in journalism school in I think it was the fall of 82, and they still had that monster machine set up with big
Yeah.
cables all over it, and
Oh yeah, there's still monster
there
machines.
are.
And but there's also, it was really sad. They gave me, it was after hours. It was because I gave the talk at the end of the day. It was just kind of a colloquium or seminar, and then after that, these two guys gave me a tour of the lab, and but the saddest part was all there was all this equipment that built at great expense and crafted with great craftsmanship, and it all had been mothballed when the money for the project was withdrawn several years ago, but. So they were hanging in there. The two people I talked to seemed, just kind of depressed about the whole thing, and especially this one guy who's really great. He was talking about how gung ho he used to be, and just over the years, he's just starting to wonder if, this is ever going to amount to anything.
Oh, Jesus. I mean, that writing was on the wall 25 years ago.
Well, yeah, but there's still things going on there and at Sandia Labs with these inertial confinement where they're trying to hold the little fusion reaction together long enough to get more energy out than you have to put in to contain it. So, I guess there's two views. I mean, one is that in theory this should be great and it's engineering, it's getting the engineering right, and the others saying there's only so much you can do with engineering, that some forces are just too mighty even for us humans to
You
harness.
know, this should be a golden era for fusion research because of global warming and the quest for a cheap, clean, inexhaustible source of energy. And it is a tragedy that in
Yeah.
this period when we could use this more than ever. I mean, the field has really collapsed. And I was wondering if we should say anything about the election and its effect on science. There was just a little piece by
Oh,
Kenneth
I
Chang.
don't know. It's just too depressing to think about.
Well, you
But
know, actually, I,
yeah, jump right in.
well, just a couple of statistics. This is from a piece by Ken Chang in the Times right after the election. How will this affect science? And these kinds of stories make me squeamish. I mean, there are such catastrophic effects from the takeover of some of these conservative nuts. But and the economy is doing badly, whether you know it's run by Democrats or Republicans. But the Republicans have pledged to have deep cuts in non-military R&D on the level of, let's see, 12.3% in that's science and health research. National Institutes of Health would drop by about 10%. National Science Foundation by 19%. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, by about 34%. Of course, that's
they're going after them on global warming.
Right.
So
fusion was already in huge trouble going back a long time. I just can't imagine how they're going to survive. And of course, what happens? The death of a field really occurs when you get the talented young people just staying away because they realize that there's no future, or they're dependent on government grants and that probably just won't be there.
I was surprised. Even the other reason I was out east is, I mentioned I was doing some interviews for the book I'm writing on the science of cancer, and I also sat in for a couple of days on a meeting that was sponsored by the American Association for Cancer Research, mm-hmm. and they were bringing basically they invited some of the real what they considered the most promising postdocs who applied to the seminar on what they call translational research in cancer, mm-hmm. and the idea being that there's all this nitty-gritty basic research done on intracellular signaling pathways and things, and just huge amounts of these micro results, and yet how do you get those things more quickly translated into clinical, the clinical setting where they might actually result in some kind of new targeted therapy. But the really interesting thing about the meeting was that they gave kind of a crash refresher course, or not even a refresher course, a crash course in clinical cancer research to these people who really did the more basic molecular stuff. And it was just kind of a nice educational opportunity for me. But then in between, sitting around like at dinner and lunch and talking to some of these young postdocs, these really smart people, and almost everyone was expressing worries about getting jobs in cancer research.
Right.
And talking about the cutbacks, and if they're cutting back cancer research, you can imagine what's going to happen to what's left of any support for plasma fusion or high energy particle physics, and the United States' contribution to the LHC.
Yeah, before we switch back to physics, and you just gave me three or four segues back to physics right there. I have to ask you about a big study that was just, published yesterday, and it's reported on in the Times today. I heard a reporter on NPR talking about it this morning. It has to do with CT scans that can detect lung cancer supposedly at a very early stage. And these are very expensive tests. They have been very controversial. There have been some studies suggesting that they really don't extend life at all. They become big money makers for some hospitals. This study said that annual CT scans, this is the front page of a story by Gardner Harris in the Times, of current and former heavy smokers reduced their risk of death from lung cancer by 20%. A big government finance study has found. But here's the thing, George, and of course we've talked about this before. Buried in this piece by Gardner Harris, and this was also in the NPR report, came way down after this very positive lead, was the fact that you are 100 times more likely to get a false positive from one of these tests than you are to get a test that will actually save your life or significantly extend your life.
100 times more.
100 times.
And what do you do with a false positive of lung cancer?
So I just don't, this is comparable to the studies that have shown that if you get a prostate test, you are 40 times more likely. I think that was the figure to get a not necessarily a false positive, but a test that will lead to unnecessary treatment than treatment that will actually save your life or extend your life significantly. Mammograms, it's a similar situation.
But here, though, I mean, they're talking about, you know, reduction in mortality, you know, like catching these tumors early enough that maybe there's some hope of, you know, treating them with, you know, the standard therapies. And in the future, there may be much more effective, you know, targeted therapies and targeted drugs. So, you know, it seems like something that, you know, if not now, could, still be an important breakthrough.
I guess so. What worries me, you know, every one of these big studies I see in the context of the just insane skyrocketing of healthcare costs, which are really driven to a great extent by these tests.
So you have to decide: is everybody who's at some point in their life been a heavy smoker going to be wanting to be regularly screened with this expensive technology, or people who have maybe other risk factors or early signs? But then I guess the whole point is to get it before you have the early signs.
Yeah, I don't know. This whole area, I think it's this is one area of research. I hope they don't cut the budget of, because it's so important for maintaining our health at a reasonable cost in the future.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just wanted to get your thoughts.
Yeah, no, I hadn't actually read the story yet, and I was kind of scanning through it while we talked.
Well, so...
So I don't want to say anything. I don't have a definitive opinion, but...
I know you're going to straighten it all out in your book, George. We're counting on you.
I don't know, but any time you can catch these things earlier, you know, it's almost always good. But, you know, you're right. In the case of breast cancer, they have what they call in situ carcinomas. And, you know, the whole idea there is these little tumors would never have been found in the past and in most cases never would have created any harm.
That's the problem.
You know, basically the tumor was growing so very, very, very slowly. It was just... I don't know if it's fair to say barely malignant, but and of course these then show up on the statistics as, you know, what appears to be an increased rate of breast cancer when it's an artifact of better screening, and women have these removed, you know, because, you know, the argument, which would be hard to resist as well, you know. Just in case, it can't hurt, although, of course, you know, it can. There's always bad side effects from surgery. But, one prominent cancer researcher that I interviewed during this trip to Boston said off the record that he thought, you know, some huge number of people who, you know, were like appearing on TV last month, which was, you know, National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, who were described as breast cancer survivors, he said, you know, a significant percent of those are people who were diagnosed with these in situ harmless carcinomas, and they really didn't have anything to survive, but they got the surgery, and, you know.
Jesus.
So it's really,
and we're paying,
it's really confusing.
And we're paying for that.
Well, you know,
through our higher,
not you and I personally.
Well, yeah, we are, George, through our higher health insurance premiums.
Well, yeah, but I don't know. It's you know, I guess we have basically different views on this. You know, I think our society can afford the technologies that allow us to err on the side of caution.
Jesus, but we can't afford it.
No, I'm saying we really should be able to afford that. And we spend our money on other things. But, if you're going to be absolutely, you know, looking at society, our screwed up society and priorities now, no, we can't afford it. And of course, there's a whole separate issue of the harm that's done, you know, with false positives and finding things, you know, that over treatment.
Well, Should we leave this messy human science and go to the clear?
Yeah, we should, because I was I'm not really. I've just been so immersed in reading about cancer, but I'm still back with the dinosaur cancers and the Egyptian mummies. And there was actually a really interesting paper last month in Nature Reviews about how much cancer had been found in antiquity. So I'm kind of working up an essay for the Times about that. But let's move on to physics. And
there's a bunch of things we could talk about, and maybe we can skim over all of them. Maybe we could start with Stephen Hawking's new book, since that has not surprisingly become an instant bestseller.
Right.
And it's it really works as a follow-up to Brief History of Time. Brief History of Time gave a whole history of physics and posed this possibility of a final theory of physics that would really wrap up this grand quest to understand the basic laws of nature and what reality is made of and where the universe came from in the first place and why it has the laws we discover rather than some entirely different laws. And this book actually, I mean, I gave it a pretty negative review in the New York Times.
Yeah, you sure did.
I mean, excuse me, in Scientific American. But
it was more like you were reviewing Hawking personally, I think.
Yeah, it was very ad hominem. I'll explain that in a second, but... I just want to say that I do think that the book is, it really works as a kind of summary of what particle physics and cosmology are about and you know, sort of the foundations of knowledge and what has led them to where they are now. What I found really disappointing in the book, although I guess it wasn't really that surprising, was that he comes out in favor of something called M theory, which is kind of the latest iteration of string theory, which goes back about 30 years. And M theory is a version of that. The M stands for a bunch of different things.
Magical, mystery, mother of all theories.
It's
basically, it basically grew out of superstring theory when they showed that there were four or five different formulations. It's been so long since I've written about this.
Yeah, and
if you're gonna write about a candidate for the great theory, the elusive theory of everything, I mean, what else would you focus on?
Well,
here's
the thing: if you go back to the beginning of the quest for a unified theory, which would explain all the forces of nature in one tidy mathematical package and unite quantum mechanics and relativity, the goal, and it was expressed really, really well by Einstein. Einstein once said he wanted to know whether the old one, whether God, had any choice in making the universe. Steven Weinberg has really talked eloquently about this too, that what you want out of a final theory is something that's logically inevitable, and if it's tweaked in any way, then it would become absurd somehow, and it wouldn't yield meaningful reality. What has happened is that you've got exactly the opposite situation. So M theory.
Well, it's come down to the landscape. Basically, he gets into the landscape, right?
Right.
I mean, this idea that there's this huge. You could just imagine this hypothetical landscape of possible universes with all these peaks and valleys, and then we're somewhere down in one of these, and then the question is if there's a way to explain why we're at one certain point, and that's more likely than finding ourselves at another point, and that's been, completely elusive. So, there's the other view. What's his name? Lenny Susskind.
Right.
You know, at Stanford, who's just, basically kind of, embraces that idea and gives it an interesting twist. And we've talked about that before.
Yes, we have. But, I talked about this with Sean Carroll. And so
right.
Basically what physicists are trying to do is turn a bug into a feature. So they are embracing the idea that here you have a theory that basically predicts every single possible physical reality that you can imagine. So that
it's
like, for all intents and purposes, it's an infinite number of universes that can be generated by M theory. And so then the question is why we live in this particular universe. And as you know, Hawking relies on the anthropic principle, which basically says that the universe has to be the way we find it, because if it was otherwise, then we wouldn't be here to observe it. That the anthropic principle explains why we have this set of laws. So that to me,
yeah, that's basically Susskind. You know, I mean, he wrote. I reviewed, you know, the book in which he laid that out. I thought, you know, even though I'm probably as dubious as you are, almost, I thought he really laid it out rather nicely. Mm-hmm.
That was my review
in the New York Times book review, and the first sentence I still remember was, "This is your universe on acid."
Right.
But it's a good book. But, you know, yeah, it's very, very speculative. And so you're saying in the new Hawking book, he's, you know, just kind of reaches the same point. But I guess what I'm saying is, what other, if you were going to write a book by Stephen Hawking,
Here's what I would expect.
I mean, where else would you end up? I mean, he's not going to. The other place he could go was with you know, Lee Smolin and his loop quantum gravity, which is kind of an alternative theory, but that doesn't really seem to be going anywhere.
You certainly
don't hear much about it.
You could say Hawking himself talked in the early 80s, and even in Brief History and Time, also about this goal of having a theory that kind of explained itself somehow,
no boundary,
right? And the fact that we've got the opposite situation, and he's presenting it as a good thing, as the fulfillment of this ancient quest, I just see as you know, it's I think it's dishonest. I think he should point out that they've got this kludgy mess here that needs to be thrown out, I don't know if they need to start from scratch or if they need to rethink the whole idea of a final quest. You know, I sent you a link to a piece by Sean Carroll, who used to appear.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, and you know, so this is a piece that he wrote for his blog, Cosmic Variance, and where he says the physics of ordinary reality is complete. The laws underlying the physics of everyday life are completely understood, which is really, which is remarkable.
It's true.
And you don't need.
And he was horribly misunderstood when he wrote that. There was this vociferous backlash, right?
Yeah.
You know, people saying, "What do you mean? We don't even understand gravity." But you know what he's saying is huge amount of the stuff that affects our everyday lives that we deal with, you know, one-on-one with our five senses, you know, has been explained, you know, really amazingly well by science.
Yes.
And then, you know, we're really out now to just like these ultimate basic questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not surprising that this stuff's going to be resistant. I mean, I think it's probably likely to be impenetrable by human minds, but you know, still, when you think of something like quantum electrodynamics, which explains basically how electrons and photons interact, mm-hmm. and that's electromagnetism. It explains, you know, why when you put your book on the table, it doesn't fall through. It explains how light ripples off a pond. It accounts for rainbows. It accounts for everything that, you know, really affects us on a sensory basis, and, you know, except for gravity.
Right.
So that's what's, you know, but that's a huge, huge amount. And I was also thinking when I read Sean of something that Freeman Dyson said in one of his essays in a book I also reviewed in the last few years. And, you know, it didn't really bother him that we had a completely different theory, you know, of quantum mechanics, and that it was, you know, so far seems to be immiscible with our theory of gravity or relativity. Mm-hmm. And he just thought, well, wow, you know, we have these two great theories that explain, you know, two huge swaths of the universe, and I don't really feel compelled to, you know, believe that they have to be consistent with each other and melded into one. So I thought, wow, that's really interesting to hear a physicist say that, because it seems to kind of go against this basic instinct that it all has to be boiled down to one set of laws. And, of course, if it can't, it raises all kinds of weird philosophical questions.
Well, that's what I love about the way that I've talked to Dyson about that issue as well. And what I love about the way he talks about these issues is that you realize that this whole obsession with unification is kind of an aesthetic or philosophical obsession instead of something that really emerges from nature itself or even from the laws of physics. I mean, we have had some extraordinary cases of unification that have led to this effort, just starting with unification of electricity and magnetism and old Faraday. You know, you can ask, well, does nature have to conform to unification like that at all possible levels? Maybe it does.
Well, it depends on if you're a Platonist and look at science as, you know, that there has to be, you know, this kind of separate set of laws. Are you still there, John? Okay. I heard a weird click, but I mean, if you're a Platonist, there's, you know, some kind of, you know, there's a tablet out there in some sort of weird hyperspace. It's always bugged me where the Platonic laws would be written, but
in the mind of God,
and that everything is consistently explained by this. And you know, you mentioned earlier, like Hawking, and it was no boundary. What was the exact name of it? He was basically showing mathematically how the universe could pull itself up out by its bootstraps and start, you know, with there being no space, you know, starting from nothing, basically, ex nihilo.
Right. The way I've always understood the no boundary proposal, the way I've always understood it is that you can think of space-time as a four-dimensional sphere, and so asking where the beginning of time was, what was there before the Big Bang, is like asking where is the end of the Earth. It's a meaningless question when you've got a spherical Earth.
Right. It's not very satisfying, though, is it?
No, it's not. And, you know, he actually he resurrects that in here. By the way, you know, you brought up my ad hominem.
The great jokester you described Hawking
as. Listen, I think, you know, I've met Hawking. I met him 20 years ago at this wonderful Nobel conference that I went to up in this little resort in northern Sweden. And I hung out with him and a bunch of these other brainiacs for, a week or so. And even though he was almost entirely paralyzed, I felt that I got a sense of the guy's personality, which also comes through in his writings. He is a joker. He's somebody who loves goofing on people. And I see his career. I mean, obviously, he's brilliant. He's really contributed a lot to theoretical physics. But I think some of his ideas are playful rather than intended to be taken seriously. And, you know, he had this idea, for example, that if the universe started collapsing at some point, then time would run backwards. It would be kind of like the movie Benjamin Button, and we'd go back into the womb of our mothers. He just talked last spring about how there almost certainly are evil aliens out there, and we should be careful of trying to find them because they might be really nasty to us. I just think the guy is goofy, and he's got this very playful, creative side to him. And
That's not so unusual though for the real high top theoretical physicists. I mean, they love to like throw out these, you know, what if proposals, and you know, it's kind of like, you know, the crazy idea of the week, and you never know, you know, some of those crazy ideas might lead to, you know, some less crazy ideas.
That's true. I guess I was just floating the idea that maybe he's not serious, because this M theory plus the anthropic principle represents a complete reversal of how he was talking about the final theory of physics 25, 30 years ago.
So, yeah, but then that's true of that's true of high energy physics in general. Yeah, I mean they've had to shift views, and now they're in this what some people would describe as a philosophical crisis.
Well, George, you asked, what could somebody like Hawking say if you're talking about where the quest for some kind of final theory or unifying theory is now. And I'll just throw something else at you. Here's another segue back to a recent event. And that's the death of Benoit Mandelbrot, the pioneer of fractal theory. So Mandelbrot was a brilliant applied mathematician. He worked for IBM for a long time, and he was really kind of an outsider in mathematics. Was denigrated by a lot of the other great mathematicians of his era, but contributed in lots of different ways to mathematics, and especially by exploring the properties of fractals. And he actually coined the term fractal to describe these mathematical objects that have a fractional dimensionality. So somewhere between a line and a two-dimensional plane, you can get objects that are kind of fuzzy. And these can be very precisely defined mathematically, and you've got physical analogs of fractals in the form of coastlines, for example, which have fuzzy borders, or clouds. And so a lot of these...
Yeah, so it was a very powerful mathematical tool for describing things that had been, you know, somewhat elusive before.
Right. And when Mandelbrot died, it just reminded me, and I wrote a piece about this for Scientific American, it reminded me of when I was just starting out in science journalism in the 1980s. It was a really heady time. It was the beginning of chaos theory. And then, you know, a big event even for science journalists like you and me, or certainly for me, was the publication of Jim Glick's book, Chaos.
Yeah, right.
Which had these amazing portraits of all these people who were creating chaos theory, including Mandelbrot. And
yeah, it was a great book. I went to Jim's book party.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we were both still at the Times then, and yeah, that book blew me and a lot of people away.
I was at his book party too at the Museum of Natural History, right?
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But, you know, the idea of it was that...
We must have seen each other, because I think we knew each other then.
Oh, well,
anyway,
I'm sure we shot the shit there. But the idea of it was that it was sort of vaulting past that old-fashioned fuddy-duddy... science dating back to Einstein and Newton, and was creating this whole new way of looking at nature and using computers and some of these new mathematical techniques like fractals to create a new science that was going to be kind of anti-reductionist, and the rhetoric was really exciting. And Mandelbrot was just one of many figures from that era.
Yeah.
And it reminded me that...
But I don't think that's really describes the overall tenor of the book. I mean, there were people in the book who were really, you know, more excited about it than others. But basically, you know, it just laid out the science in this really neat way, you know, through, you know, meeting the people who were actually doing it and going, you know, way back to the history with Lorentz and the Lorentz attractors.
Strange attractors.
Yeah. Then the strange attractors, and then the Mandelbrot set, and which has been responsible for who knows how many book jackets and books of all different subjects.
Right.
You know, having that picture of the Mandelbrot set.
What?
It's kind of like the Horsehead Nebula. You know, there's just
a woody
great scientific weird abstract pictures of all times. But anyway, so to get back to chaos and...
Well, so chaos encompassed all these more specific approaches, and chaos, of course, morphed into complexity, and there was all this exciting work being done at the Santa Fe Institute. And again, it was the idea, well, I mean, there are all sorts of ideas, and it was just this period of great intellectual...
Yeah.
Ferment, but the basic idea of it for me was that a whole new way of doing science would be created, and there could be this new way of modeling nature that could apply to systems at all different possible scales and wildly different types of phenomena, anything from particle physics all the way up to economics. So it was very ambitious.
It was a powerful tool for modeling. And turbulence and things like that, or if not really, modeling it in a predictive sense of getting a better, a better intuitive sense of how it works.
Right.
Yeah.
And it just reminded me that, I guess the heyday was maybe mid-80s to mid-90s or so. And
As far as, popular expositions and, books and articles, but all of that stuff, kind of becomes absorbed into the scientific mainstream and becomes, little subjects that pop up in all different fields during conferences, but it's just not, singled out as like a revolution. So,
right.
And that's, so it's had a huge effect.
Well, it's had a huge effect, but what had been potentially revolutionary theories become tools. Or applications.
Yeah, well, it's like so many things, like artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. It was talked about, for a while as though we were going to have these, brains in a box, basically, these digital devices that would, seem very human-like in their intelligence. And, like in Richard Power's novel, Galatea 2.0.
I love that book.
And, it turns out more that... artificial intelligence are just very, very powerful, flexible. It's hard to know what you mean by intelligent, but that kind of processing has just become embedded in our everyday tools and objects.
Right.
And, just like when you go on Google and it anticipates what you want to search for, mm-hmm. although that's not a lot like what they were looking at in traditional AI because it's done so much, by statistics and.
Right.
No one really anticipated that we would be able to take these huge statistical samples of people's behavior or of a language so rapidly with such powerful computers and kind of do this, rough and ready type of AI instead of actually understanding how the mind does it.
Well, I guess the question I wanted to pose about, so you're saying that this is sort of the natural process of the cycle of science and to a certain extent of popularization of science journalism that
and then it gets absorbed.
People get excited about something like fractals or self-organized criticality or genetic algorithms and chaos complexity, and then the excitement settles down and a lot of the stuff turns out to be garbage, but there's some genuine advances that are incorporated into previous science.
I think a lot of genuine advances. No, I think that's even true of something like catastrophe theory, René Thom. And, again, it's something where it comes out, and, from us outsiders looking in, it seems like this huge radical, change that's going to lead to a whole new way to do science. And then... a few years later, they're talking about something else. Well, before that, there was cybernetics, there was general systems theory. But all of this stuff, ends up having an effect and gets absorbed, including catastrophe theory. It's just that nobody really singles it out as this revolutionary force anymore. It just kind of expands in subtle ways our understanding.
Well, here's the question I had. Do you think that means that a theory that actually lives up to some of that really excited rhetoric that you had at the beginning of chaos theory, at the beginning of catastrophe theory, cybernetics, all these things that we've been talking about that you just mentioned. Do you think at this point that scientists don't really think it's possible to have a theory that is as powerful as for a brief period we thought chaos theory was?
I don't think. Well, some of them no doubt think that, probably particularly the older ones. But, I think there's still that same excitement that there's just something around the corner.
Yeah, well, I don't know. That's why I was, when Mandelbrot died, it sort of made me realize that, the last time I heard the kind of rhetoric that you got from the late 80s about chaos and complexity was when Steve Wolfram published his book, A New Kind of Science,
Oh, yeah, but it's a great, great book.
Yeah, but it's just cellular automata. It's one of these tools that goes way back. Wolfram was saying it's going to revolutionize science. It didn't even come close to happening. But actually...
Well, no, but, but you know, what 10 years ago? I mean...
New kind of science.
I'm not sure. I think we have different expectations on what people mean when they say revolutionize science.
Yeah.
But... Yeah, again, I think it's had an effect.
And well, here's
I don't know. I've just I reviewed that book too. I'm just going to post all these things because they're all things I've written about, and at some point you just kind of get to where, you know, maybe this is what you're getting at. You just think there's nothing new under the sun, and none of this stuff ever pans out. But I know that's not really true. I have to. You know, fight that.
Well,
you know, negative fatalism.
Well, it's that things are. Actually, I've been talking to my students at Stevens about this. I try to give them a healthy dose of skepticism, and
you do.
You know, too much. So I realize because in the last couple of classes, some of my students, I realized they've become total skeptics. So they think everything is bullshit, and I have to tell them, no, that's not what I'm saying. Science is capable of genuine, enduring, brilliant, beautiful insights into nature, but those are rare. Those are very rare, and they're very difficult to accomplish, and the challenge is to distinguish what is genuine and enduring from the bullshit. The vast majority of what you hear about does turn out to be bullshit. So somehow you have to recognize that and not become so cynical and jaded that you just throw up your hands at everything that you hear.
Yeah, okay. No, that sounds exactly right.
But here, you know, I just want to mention
and remembering too that in science it's so much harder to put lasting bullshit out there.
Yes.
Than it is in any other, you know, field of endeavor. I mean, it's really unique in that sense. Mm-hmm. You know, that things are tested, they, you know, and usually replicated, although it's, you know, true that, you know, there are certain results. I was thinking about when the Lawrence Livermore lab years ago, not too many years ago, last 10 years or so. I can never remember when all this stuff happened. It just gets so compressed in my mind, but when they claimed to have discovered element 118, and then no one could, you know, it took a while before, you know, people tried to replicate it, but experiments like that are so expensive and so difficult, and everything has to be so precisely right to get the result that replication sometimes doesn't happen for years, if it does at all. And in this case, you know, they ended up having to withdraw the result, and they did these amazing forensics that indicated that there was fabricated data, although the person accused of that, you know, just insisted till the end that that wasn't the case. So
Hey,
can we talk about the Large Hadron Collider?
Yeah, I just want to mention one thing before we switch to that just an odd coincidence. Hawking ends his book talking about cellular automata, and particularly the game of life, the cellular automaton invented by the mathematician John Conway, which exemplifies how really simple laws can generate phenomenal complexity. So it's just interesting that after talking about M-theory and the anthropic principle, Hawking suddenly is talking about something that's more familiar from the things we were just talking about, chaos and complexity theory and some of these older mathematical and computational tools.
Well, there's another place he could have, you know, after doing M-theory in the landscape, he could have, you know, pointed out, you know, I haven't read the book, so I'm just, you know, speculating. He could have pointed out, you know, the weaknesses and dissatisfactions with that as opposed, you know, and balanced that against the potential excitement, and then suggested that maybe there's this whole new way to do physics, which is digital physics based on cellular automata and Wolfram's ideas, which, you know, he lays out in his massive book, which I would recommend anyone who's interested in these things read, you know, the first 50 or so pages, because it's a very clear exposition, and after that it quickly becomes very difficult, and But it's real. I think it really is, you know, interesting stuff. And you know, some of the complaints about the book that have, you know, come out. Like, I know some of my friends at the Santa Fe Institute were really mad at me because I gave the book such a good review in the Times, and you know, and they felt that you know, that other people who'd been working in the same area of digital physics and cellular automata computation, and you know, that they hadn't really, you know, that Wolfram had made it sound too much like it was all his idea,
right,
which is a complaint that you often hear.
Yeah.
But the book is, you know, it is well referenced and footnoted, and so.
You're just a big-hearted, generous person, George, and much
oh,
more so
varies,
than I am.
Yeah.
I'm flinty-hearted, yeah, and you know, always looking for the bad and things, and so.
You know, I'm just trying to be optimistic lately because, you know, going through a difficult time, so.
Yeah.
I don't want to get into that. I didn't mean to say that.
Okay.
Wait,
but
before
you.
We get off the, blip that out. Before we get off, you know, these two pieces you wrote, there was something in the one about Hawking that struck me. You said he was imagining this idea of computers becoming so advanced that they basically do science with each other and maybe discover something like the theory of everything, and we can't even understand
right.
it. Yeah, it was really funny because I just was reading some short stories that were recommended by a friend of mine. I'll hold up the book. It's called Stories of Your Life and Others by Ted Chiang.
Mm-hmm.
And this is amazing. It's like, you know, I guess the genre is science fiction, but very, very literary science fiction and interestingly mathematical. And he has this one piece that actually appeared in the journal Nature, of all places. And I guess he explains why that was. There was something where each issue they were asking people who wouldn't normally be seen in Nature, like this young science fiction writer, to do these little, you know, essays or imaginary riffs.
I remember that. I remember when Nature was doing that. It was a great idea.
Oh, okay. Okay. So it's called, I should have put a bookmark in here. I know this is the sort of thing that drives our viewers crazy. The Evolution of Human Science. Mm-hmm. And just this very nice short little piece. And he imagines just this, that, you know, the computers have basically become so advanced that they take off and they're doing the science and or whatever it is. We don't even know if, you know, it's science. And, you know, there's just some complex thing that's obviously engaging them because, you know, they're so advanced they can apparently be engaged, or so it appears to us looking from the outside in. And then it gets to the point that all we can do is study these machines and, like, take measurements and, you know, do statistical analyses in trying to do our own science to try to explain, you know, get a little hint of what this meta-science is that the computers are developing.
That's cool.
It's really a mind-blowing little story.
That's already happening with computer proofs, where the mathematicians are kind of on the
right.
outside looking in, and you know, they get the result produced by the computer, but the human mathematicians
yeah.
can't understand it.
Yeah, or you could never go through it step by step.
Yeah.
So you just kind of have to take core samples. You know, it's just like becomes another science in itself. So you know, you put in the core and pull it out, and you say, well, this looks all kind of consistent, and. It's just really, it reminded me too, again, of, you know, some of the stuff that Google's doing with massive, you know, massive statistics on human behavior. And,
well,
the great beast of the internet is being kind of poked and prodded and studied and core sampled.
Uh-huh.
And we're trying to figure out what this phenomenon is.
Well, I just remember when I hear about computers or robots doing their own science, I remember that Marvin Minsky once said, you know, the pioneer of artificial intelligence, once said that he thought that no matter how brilliant computers became, they would still be stumped by the mystery of their own consciousness or their own minds and would never be able to
yeah.
solve the riddle of free will.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
that's great. That's great
right.
that he said that.
There are two things I want to be sure we cover. One is
one's LHC.
Yeah, one
so
is the LHC.
Save some minutes for
I'll
that.
Just say very quickly. Here's the mean side of me. I think Dennis. I love Dennis Overby's coverage of physics and cosmology. He's got a poetic soul. This was a particularly boosterish piece of his, and I thought that the lead was buried. So it basically mentioned that they're so worried that this thing is going to break down.
We should back up and give a little context that this is the Large Hadron Collider, the super super particle collider in Europe that it's been very frustrating because, you know, when they first powered it up, you know, to really try to bring it to full power, they had this huge magnet meltdown, and then having to do all these repairs, and now they're using it at lower powers than it's designed to be used at. But, you know, according to Dennis's article, they're beginning to find some possibly interesting physics.
Well, so the part that I'm
saying... So now throw cold water on that.
Well, the part that I'm saying was the buried lead points out that the machine is only operating at half power now, and so it was originally designed for 7 trillion electron volts, and... They're basically, at the end of this year, they're going to shut it down again. I mean, it's already gone through these extended shutdowns. This thing was supposed to be operating years ago. And they have to redo all these splices that are thought to have led to this catastrophic failure a couple of years ago.
Yeah, right. Little sparks from bad wire splices, apparently. Badly soldered wire splices, you know, sparked and penetrated this huge volume of liquid helium. And he has a great description of that. He describes it as creating so much force, all these huge magnets are just being thrown around inside the tunnel like so many toys, and it was very visual. But, so you're right. They're working at half power now, 3.5 as opposed to 7 trillion.
And they won't be at full power until 2014. And to me, I'm thinking about young people who are trying to decide whether to go into this once very glamorous, exciting, well-funded field of high-energy physics. Why would you? It just, the whole thing looks so shaky.
Yeah, but again, like the, at Fermi, you know, the next biggest collider is the Tevatron at Fermilab, right? And that's basically 1 trillion electron volts. And when you're colliding two beams of particles going around in different directions, it approaches 2 trillion. So, you know, the broken LHC now is already, you know, almost double that.
That's true. See?
And then they're talking about, you know, if they get it up to close to full power, what they're saying is maybe 6.5 and it won't quite be 7, but, you know, still that's multiples more powerful. But what really depressed me was after reading Dennis's article, which I thought was, you know, I mean, to me it just showed that there's still really interesting physics they're doing. And like they had this Maria Spirapula, who's a really, really cool particle physicist that I've written about, and she was talking about an event that they saw, which was a candidate for a dark matter particle, but, you know, then quickly pointing out that, you know, one event is meaningless, that you have to get the statistics to see if there's something real. But, you know, to me that kind of held out some hope that there might be some new data that can start constraining these theories of everything, or maybe pushing them in a different direction. Mm-hmm. Oh, but then, to continue my rambling thought, after reading Dennis's story, I went back and read, I think he mentioned the superconducting supercollider, and I read more about that, and either I read somewhere else, or he points out that the superconducting supercollider, which this one that was going to be built in Texas until Congress pulled the plug on the funding, which kind of brings us full circle to the beginning of our conversation, that would have been 30 trillion electron volts. So this would have been like 4 to 5 times more powerful than the LHC will be, even if it gets up to full power.
Right.
And this was, you know, so long ago, and then they just decided, you know, we're not going to do this.
That's a real embodiment of how high energy particle physics has had to scale back its ambitions. Hey, listen, I'd like to end on a positive note.
Hey, good idea.
We only have 5 minutes left. I want to talk about a really wonderful piece by Natalie Angier in the same issue of Science Times. And I'm just looking
right
here. The title is Seeing the Natural World with a Physicist's Lens. And it's about a guy named William Bialek, who's at Princeton, and I guess he also operates out of City University of New York. And he's one of these sort of polymath kind of guys. I think his training is in physics, but he's also somebody who knows a lot about computer science, about information processing or information theory. And he has invaded the turf of biologists. Natalie, I don't think, mentions it in here, but I know about this guy primarily because of his impact on neuroscience, and particularly the search for a neural code, the mm-hmm. kind of the software that turns little electrochemical pulses into our
right.
brains, into thoughts and perceptions and so forth. And Bialek was somebody who was challenging some of the conventional models of information processing in the brain and showing that they mm-hmm. couldn't possibly explain some of these extraordinary feats of perception of insects, for example. And he had mm-hmm. He had experiments that he'd done on fly vision that showed that the information processing had to be operating right at the limits of what is theoretically possible, physically possible, according to information theory. And
right.
that couldn't be explained according to conventional information processing models of neuroscience, most of which involve something called rate coding, where information is just mm-hmm. a function of the rate of firing of different neurons.
Right.
Bialek said there had to be a much more complicated, efficient, compressed kind of scheme.
Some kind of code,
representing
yeah.
information.
So it's not just faster or slower firing, but
yeah.
you know, some kind of more subtle, complex rhythm.
So there was a lot of resistance to his ideas because he was a classic scientific interloper coming into this.
Right, the physicist getting into neuroscience.
Right, so. But he just, you know, I've got to admit, so I interviewed him, this must have been 5 or 6 years ago when I was doing a big piece on the neural code, and the work he does for me was very difficult to understand. He wrote a book called either Spike or Spikes about mm-hmm. his information theory views of neuroscience. Very, very technical, but fascinating stuff. And I tell you, if I was a smart young kid trying to figure out which area of science to go into, I would really try to learn all I could about what William Bialek is doing, because this fusion of neuroscience and computer theory and information theory
yeah.
and all that stuff to me and physics just seems really to have lots of potential.
Yeah. You know, it kind of reminds me of when the physicists were starting to get into breaking the genetic code, or even just before that with Erwin Schrödinger and his book What Is Life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some ways abstractly, you know, anticipating DNA replication in the genetic code, and then people like George Gamow and the RNA tie club. They have their little club with different, you know, amino acids on their ties, and, you know, getting the physicists' input, you know, along with the molecular biologists. And, of course, these outsiders are always, you know, resented a little bit, and
mm-hmm.
and but sometimes they do shake things up. And,
yeah. Francis Crick was a physicist.
That's
who
right.
Who became one of the
that's
greatest
right.
molecular biologists and geneticists
that's
in history.
That's right. And then became a neuroscientist.
Right.
And, Yes.
So
when I was in Boston too, I was talking. This is another story I'm working on: is physicists getting into cancer research, and you see that same resistance. I mean, like, you know, what do physicists know about cancer research? And we've seen this before, and nothing really, really came of it. But you know, I find that kind of stuff just really exciting.
Right. You know, so
the idea of shaking loose totally new ideas and perspectives in a field.
Well, so this seems like the kind of cross-disciplinary research that was being described in the books about chaos and complexity at its best, where you got this cross-fertilization from people in different fields, and sometimes not much came of it. I mean, information theory has turned out to have amazing applications in digital communications and media and so forth.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that's become basic.
Yeah, but it's also been over-applied in lots of areas. There have been attempts to fuse information theory with quantum mechanics that turned out to be not as productive as some people had thought originally.
Yeah, well, so far.
Yeah, yeah. But this, to me, seems, I mean, it's...
I hate being the incurable optimist.
Yeah, in some respects... I, you know, the brain clearly is some kind of it's some kind of information processing device, and in certain respects, it really is a digital computer. So
it's some level of abstraction.
Yeah,
not a von Neumann type processor, but yeah. Then again, you really start digging into this, and you know, what the hell is information?
Right.
You know, the difference that makes a difference, Gregory Bateson called it.
Nice.
You know, it's the presence or absence, all or none. It's it's really another nice rabbit hole to go down, but
right.
Maybe another time.
Yeah, information is like entropy or even energy, or is one of those scientific terms that gets bandied about, and then the more you look at it, the more mysterious it becomes.
Yeah, there's by one perspective, a random string of digits has more information than an orderly one.
Right.
And then that makes you wonder if your definition is inside out. But yeah, let's do it. Let's do a whole talk about that sometime.
Okay. I was just trying to explain the second law of thermodynamics to my students this week.
Oh,
and man,
wow.
Did I get tied up in knots. And then, of course, whenever I get in trouble like that, I try to justify it by saying, you know, the smartest people in science disagree about what entropy really means, and their whole books written by scholars and philosophers debating the meaning of terms like this.
Did you use Maxwell's demon?
I didn't get into that. I think maybe I'll tell them about that next week.
Ah, Maxwell's demon would be a good approach.
Yeah. Definitely.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut
you
off.
No, I can draw the little diagram and everything.
Yeah.
All right, man. I think we've filled our hour.
Just barely over an hour. That sounds good.
So
till next time.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you again, really.
Yeah, you too, John.
All right, talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.